Welcome back to the podcast. It's show 113, and we're joined this time by Steve Gosling, author of Lensless Landscapes, whose book has been an inspiration for me and many other pinhole photographers. So hope you enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome back to the Lensless podcast. This is show 113. It's been 2 or 3 weeks, but before that it was 2 or 3 months, so I don't suppose you're complaining too much. It's just me in terms of hosts today. Corey, as you've probably gathered, is super busy, and I chatted with him a few weeks ago and we just agreed that we'd get guests lined up, and whoever's free to do the chatting, the interviewing, then we just crack on with it. So today it's just me, but we do have someone who, if you're a long-time listener to the show, you'll be aware that has been an influence for me to pick up my zero image camera and some Pan F film and focus on the landscapes with a pinhole camera in a way that I didn't for a long time. So we're joined today by Steve Gosling, and before I speak to him, I'll just read the about the photographer bit in his book, Lensless Landscapes. I think it's, as this was 2008, he's probably got more to add to this, but we'll let Steve do that. So let me just read this. He's probably a lot older than he looks in this photograph as well. Aren't we all? Steve Gosling is a professional photographer who specializes in producing creative and contemporary landscape and nature images. His photographs have been published internationally as posters, on greetings cards, in books, magazines, newspapers, and calendars across the world. Prints of his work have been exhibited in venues throughout the UK and have appeared on sets for both theatre and film productions. Steve's work has won many awards. In 2006, photographs shot with his pinhole camera won the Places category and achieved runner-up place in the Inkjet Printer of the Year section of the UK's Black and White Photographer of the Year competition. He also enjoys writing and teaching about photography and is a regular contributor to many of the major photographic magazines in the UK. For several years, he has run a programme of workshops for photographers of all levels and regularly gives talks to photographic societies and other groups. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you very much for inviting me along. It's good to chat to you.
That's okay. I first reached out to you ages ago, and then you fell off my radar, and then I was hosting a workshop here with, oh, he's going to be really cross with me. Who was it? Was it John Ash? I don't know.
Probably John Ash,
Do you know John?
Yes, I certainly do. Know him well. Good guy.
Right. Yes. So John is running little bookbinding workshops as well now, isn't he?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Very creative guy.
Yeah, so John came here for a day in the darkroom back end of last year, I think.
Right.
And I said, we really need to get Steve on the show. And he just reminded me of your email, but which I could have found if I'd have just looked on your website.
Well, that's okay. I'm glad that he pointed you in my direction. That's good. And I'm glad that you reminded me that I look much older than I did in the photograph in the book.
Yeah, it's always... it's always very cheering and positive to look at old photographs of yourself. I do it all the time.
Yeah. I try and avoid it personally, but there you go.
So we'll talk about the book more in a moment. But so I introduced you with this introduction that was written in 2008. So I'm sure you can do better than that, Steve. So why don't you tell us about your creative journey and how you got into photography? Tell us about your boyhood, if you had any troubled experiences. No, you don't.
I probably had plenty of those, but I've erased those from my memory, fortunately. So, I guess I got into photography when I was about 7 or 8 years old. Most of my family had cameras, although it was just sort of family snapshot stuff, except that I had an uncle who I was living in London at the time. This uncle was based in Cornwall, but he used to come up to London with his family quite often. And he was a very keen photographer, had his own darkroom shooting with a Rolleiflex, I remember. And so he got me interested in photography. And my father also had a cousin who lived not far from us in Southwest London. And he was the guy, he was a keen photographer and he had his own darkroom. He was the guy that taught me how to load film onto a processing spiral and how to process the film and how to print, et cetera, et cetera. So I got into that side of things when I was quite young. And I had an ongoing interest in photography. When I was about 13, I did consider going to study photography at college, but we're talking late 1960s. And at the time, I think photography courses were very science-based. And I started to look, and all the courses I looked at said you needed to have good school qualifications, O and A level, in physics, chemistry, and maths. And I hated those subjects with a vengeance. I mean, I was just not good at them, and I didn't enjoy them at all.
So was that for photography courses? They wanted physics and maths.
Yes.
Did they?
Physics and or chemistry and maths. And I think it was primarily because, you know, processing, understanding chemicals, understanding light, all of that stuff, okay. I think, was quite important in those days. And I have to say, I've never been a scientific photographer. And to give you a quick feel of what I mean by that, when I first got my zero image camera, I should have gone out into the garden and taken a few test exposures, but I didn't. And so I grabbed the camera and some rolls of film, and I drove about an hour and 45 minutes from home up to Saltburn on the northeast coast. And I took my spot meter with me, and I set the camera up to get my first photograph. And I took a meter reading. Oh, and I thought, you know, f/138, this is going to be a long exposure. I better load some 400 ISO film in, which I did. But it was a reasonably bright day. And when I calculated the exposure, it was half a second. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how do I measure opening and shutting this wooden piece of, you know, across the call it the lens, the pinhole. How do I make sure that's only open for half a second? And then it just dawned on me that actually driving an hour and 45 minutes to take my first exposures to learn how to do this was probably not a very scientific approach to photography. But I managed to solve it, and just to demonstrate how useless I was at maths at school, you see, I worked out that if you say 1,000, then that would give me a second. So if I said 500, that would give me half a second.
Well, half an elephant.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
For years, I counted elephants in the darkroom. Now, of course, I have an f-stop timer and can print to 1/12 of an f-stop, and my prints are so much better for it.
It's not as much fun, though, is it?
I've used Delta 3200 in one of my pinhole cameras, and that was giving... I don't know why I put Delta 3000. It was a sunny day in London as well.
Right. What sort of exposures were you getting with that?
Oh, I don't know. Some quick ones.
Yeah.
Just opened it and closed it. It was fine. I mean, don't sweat about this. I don't know about you, but my first experience with that, I know we're halfway through your introduction. We will come back, but we're okay. Just have to catch me while I'm thinking about these things. So I'll be interested to see what your views on this is. When I first got my zero image, it came with a little piece of brown paper with some pictures of how to load it, which I still have to look at today because I can never remember if I'm going to get the door back to front, you know, and then end up not reading the numbers properly.
Yeah.
So I still look at that. And it gave that little guide, didn't it? It says, if it's over 1 to 2 seconds, you know, call it 4, and if it's 5 to 10 seconds, double it or something. Do you know that little guide?
Yeah.
And it makes no reference to different film types.
No,
does it?
No.
And it never occurred to me really that back in the day, when I got mine, that there was. I mean, I knew about reciprocity, but I never really thought about it in terms of, well, I need to know exactly what that reciprocity factor is for this film or that film, and it'll change my exposure time. I just used that zero guide.
Yeah.
And I was probably helped by using HP5 for quite a lot. Well, even when I use Pan F, which some people struggle with. And that guide, you know, that guide served me really well.
Yeah.
And it was very liberating. You know, I didn't have the pinhole assist app, and I wasn't trying to be overly I wasn't trying to overly think it. I was, for years, I just used what I called the force, you know? Do you know what I mean? Use the force, Padawan.
I've already started to say, I guess, that I'm not particularly scientific in my approach to photography. That's not what turns me on. You know, I had one guy, for instance, come on a workshop who said to me, how are apertures calculated in the sense of why is it f2.8 and why is it f4 and f5.6?
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, I've been taking photographs since I was 7 and I have no idea at all, but I will find out for you.
I've probably got a book somewhere, or you can Google it, can't you?
I had this advanced photography book and I looked in the back and it told me how apertures were calculated, and I read this and I typed it out to this guy, and at the end of it, you know, I said to him, well, I hope you find that helpful, but I have to say I've read it several times, I've typed it out once, and I still don't think it's going to be of any use to me at all. I just need to know that what does the aperture do and what effect does it have on the final result? And that's all I need to know. How it's calculated, I really don't care. And it was the same with the exposure. I just, right the way through using my zero image cameras, I just double the exposure.
Mm-hmm. Irrespective of
film. Yeah. Almost, you know, irrespective of how long it happens to be, I just double the exposure. There is one photograph in my book, and it's one of my favourite pinhole images, called Into the Light, which was taken at Derwent Water. And I took an exposure reading. It was going dark. It was dusk. And I took an exposure reading, and it said the exposure, I think it was meant to be 5 minutes or something. It might have been 10 minutes. It might have been 5 minutes doubled, that made it 10. And then sort of partway through the 10-minute exposure, I'm thinking, wow, this is getting really dark. Perhaps I need to give it a bit longer.
A bit more.
So I gave it another 5 or 10 minutes, and I thought, wow, it's getting even darker. I suppose I better give it a bit more. And in the end, I got up to 40 minutes exposure, and it really was going dark by then. And I thought, you know what, Steve, you've either got this or you haven't. Unfortunately, I did. I only got the one frame, of course, but it all worked out, and I was really pleased with the final result. But you know, it was about as scientific as holding your finger up in the wind, you know.
I think so. I think you can overthink these things. At least that's what I tell myself.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at in the back of your book is handily placed what we might these days call thumbnails.
Yep.
With all the pictures, and I found Into the Light. So it's one where you've got the Lake District. In the lakes, they have these fences that recede into the water, don't they? I don't know what they do, but they have them.
Yeah.
And many a Lake District photograph will include that fence, including me, because I probably saw yours. And so your long exposure, you know, it's worked, hasn't it?
Well, it did. It worked for me. It captured the mood and the atmosphere of that particular evening in Derwent Water. And I was just pleased that, you know, the 40-minute exposure, it worked out okay for me. So, and I say, one of my favourites.
I do get anxious at times when I'm out in changing light conditions, and you take the exposure, and it, you know, it might be, I don't know, whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. But I guess if it's relatively long, for example, then and the light or the sun goes in or the sun comes out, you think, should I just go with it? Should I add a little bit more, take a little bit off?
You know? Yeah. I just go with it, really. And I used to prefer shooting in overcast light or on overcast days. The flatter the light, the better, because I could increase the contrast in processing, but it was not so easy to take the contrast out. So sort of flat grey days were ideal for me.
I think that's a mantra that I talk about a lot. I mean, it's in terms of, let's get a little bit technical, but in terms of what we talk about with subject brightness range, from sort of shadows where you want some detail and highlights where you want to retain the highlights. And often that's really tricky with pinhole photography, or it can be.
Yeah.
Then if you limit those days to 5 or 6 stops, mostly you're probably going to contain the highlights. And you see, you know, and looking at all your pictures, you've got some, most of them seem to be taken in reasonably low sunlight, I'm guessing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the clouds you retain detail in the clouds quite nicely, and
it's a real mixture really sort of softer diffuse light or overcast days, but high contrast days I'd try and avoid.
Well, you've got one very brave one at Firley, North Yorkshire, where the sun's in the picture.
Yes, that's right. That really was, let's see how far I can push this, you know, let's see what I can do with it. And it was, I mean, there's no detail in the area around the sun, but I was okay with that. It wasn't, is one of the things for me is that technical perfection has always been secondary for me. It's much more about communicating a mood, an emotion, a feeling, rather than having a technically perfect image. Mm-hmm. And I know this is probably sacrilege for a landscape photographer to say this, but if you gave me the choice between an Ansel Adams print and, say, one taken by a lady photographer whose work I like, Susan Bernstein, I don't know if you've come across her work. She makes her own toy cameras, makes her own cameras using plastic lenses, and none of her images that I've ever seen are sharp. But boy, oh boy, do they convey a mood and an emotion. And I'd much rather have one of her prints. Technical perfection doesn't really float my boat too much. I mean, when it needs to be technically perfect, great. But for me, it's not the be-all and end-all of everything. You can have a technically perfect photograph that is as boring as hell. And that just doesn't do it for me.
Susan, I've got at least one. I think I've got one book by Susan Bernstein.
Yeah.
But she writes in Black and White Photography magazine, doesn't she?
Yes, that's
View,
right.
View from America or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if she still is. I haven't bought that magazine for a while, but yeah, certainly she used to. Yeah.
Oh, I get it occasionally electronically. I don't. I ran out of space for storing magazines, you know. This idea of mood and, I guess, metaphor in photography is something that was championed by that group of American photographers, people like Minor White,
and, yes. The notion of equivalence.
Equivalence, yeah. So that's like, I don't know, some bright, fluffy clouds. This is really like not noddy version of equivalent. Some picture of a nice, white, fluffy clouds on a summer's day because he felt happy.
Sort of thing. Yes, that's right. Yeah. It's about, I talk about this a lot when I'm running my workshops, that, you know, what we photograph, if we're being true to the way we're reacting to the subject, what we're photographing are often metaphors for those feelings. I rarely, the whole notion of equivalence is about taking a photograph that is about something rather than of something. I've got a photograph that I took a few years ago on a dog walk, working on this project that I could just call Walking the Dog. I'd always have the camera with me. And I photographed it was a child's baby doll and a patch of snow. And actually the patch of snow looked like a face. And I posted it on Facebook and got a whole range of reactions, you know, some saying it had quite an evil feel to it. And others saying it had quite a bright, I mean, they saw in the face of Father Christmas, and some child sat on Father Christmas's knee, to this is some evil spirit sucking the soul out of a baby. And I just responded and said to these comments, that's quite interesting, because if you look at what it is a photograph of, it's a photograph of some plastic and some frozen water. That is what it is a photograph of, but that's not what it is a photograph about. And for me, the power of photography is about taking photographs that are about things rather than of things.
And you picked up a pinhole camera when then? How did that come about, and how did that then? Had you already latched onto this idea of mood and metaphor and equivalence in your photography before pinhole, and how did that change when you picked up the pinhole camera?
That's an interesting question, and I suspect it was pinhole photography that it was one of those sort of watershed moments for me that took my photography in a different direction, made me think more deeply about what I was doing rather than just trying to photograph an attractive scene. How I got into it was actually Black and White Photography magazine, and I used to subscribe, get it every month. Yeah. And on the back pages, there were adverts for zero imaging cameras.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder, and I looked around at pinhole photography, and I didn't find too many at that point in time. I didn't find too many landscape photographs. And so I thought, I wonder what would happen if I got a pinhole camera and I started photographing landscapes. Would that be possible? What would they look like? What could I do with that? And so I contacted the manufacturer in Hong Kong. You couldn't actually buy them in the UK at this point in time. So I contacted the manufacturer in Hong Kong and I bought my camera and got it imported into the UK. I think there are now like places like Silverprint in the UK where you can buy these things. But at the time, you couldn't buy them in the UK. And so it started out for me as a bit of an experiment. And that sort of process, I think, sums up my approach to creativity, asking that what if question. I wonder what would happen if, and then just giving it a go and seeing where it takes you.
Yeah. So Zernica, is that how you pronounce his name?
I think so.
He's in our Lensless Facebook group. I've tried to get him on the show, but he says my English is probably not up to it.
That's a shame. I've never spoken to him. We've emailed, corresponded, but it's a shame because I'm sure he's an absolutely fascinating guy to chat to.
I bought my zero image pinhole camera in 2000. Well, zero image 2000, not in 2000. I bought it in the early 2000s, probably from Silverprint when they were in London.
Right.
And I walked in and thought, what on earth is that? You know. Yeah. So I'd never made a pinhole camera. I mean, I made them since. But the zero image was my introduction to it. And it sat, I'd occasionally pick it up and go out with it. And then I saw your book and I thought, oh, he's using Pan F as well. And he's making some beautiful evocative images of places that some of which I know and some of which I didn't. So you did lead me to rekindle my interest in
pinhole
photography.
And what I find fascinating about pinhole photography is there are people doing some amazing things with some very, very different equipment. So I had an exhibition at Joe Cornish's gallery back in 2005, I think it was, of my pinhole landscape images. And there was a young lady who was at the time taking a degree in photography at Sheffield University. And one of her projects was converting a dustbin into a pinhole camera. And she'd got permission from the local school, not quite sure if you'd get permission these days to do this. And she was setting up the dustbin in the corner of the playground and had film taped to the other side of the dustbin and a piece of black electrician's tape over the pinhole at the front of the dustbin, and then would just peel it off and just let it record while the kids were running around in the playground. Some amazing photographs. I had another guy, I was giving a talk to Leeds Photographic Club about pinhole photography, and there was a guy who came up to me and he said, "Do you want to see my camera?" I said, "Yeah, okay, fine." He put his hand in his pocket and he pulled out a matchbox.
Mm-hmm.
And what he'd done is he would go in the dark room and he would tape a piece of 35mm film inside the tray of the matchbox, slide that back in to the matchbox and tape up the seam so that it was light tight. And on the front, he had a hole that he'd made in the matchbox covered in tape. And he would just go out and put the matchbox on a wall or stand it on a fence or something and then peel the tape off the front and get his photograph in. He had some absolutely amazing images, and that's what I find really, really fascinating, exactly how people go about making these images and the incredible images that they take. And I often refer to these things when I'm running workshops, when people are agonizing with me about, oh, should I get the Canon Pro lens X, Y, or Z, because I've got the consumer version, but I'm not sure it's very good. And they agonize for hours and hours over this. And I just say to them, you really don't need to care. about this. You can go out and get a fantastic image with a matchbox or a dustbin or a zero image camera. You don't have to have the best lenses, the most expensive kit available to get really good photographs.
Well, I think over the 112, 113 shows now, we've probably had folks on who've made pinhole cameras from pretty much anything, I think. You know, I've got friends who regularly use little film canisters, and sometimes they leave them up in trees for weeks on end. And I mean, it's an extremely creative way of making very simple images, and without spending a great deal of money, because let's face it, you know, film is getting really expensive.
Yeah, that's right. I quite like the absence of technological distractions, let me put it that way. You go out with the zero image camera, and you know, there's no viewfinder, there's no electronic shutter, there's no aperture to worry about, there's no focusing to worry about. You just go out and point it at something that's interesting, and hopefully, you know, you get a good photograph at the end of it.
You mentioned Joe Cornish, and folks will likely be familiar with Joe's landscape work over the years, but he wrote the foreword to your book, Lensless Landscapes. Is that exhibition that where you had, is that how your sort of relationship or friendship?
Joe and I have known each other for many years. So before I got into pinhole photography, he lives probably about 45 minutes from where I live, in North Yorkshire, and he's had his gallery in North Harton, I don't know how many years now, but for many years. And when I was first starting out on the professional road, then Joe was a great source of advice and help and support for me. And we've subsequently, we've run workshops together. I think the furthest we've been to run a workshop is New Zealand.
Wow.
We're good friends. In fact, I'm meeting him for coffee tomorrow. We try and meet every few months and chew the fat, talk about the state of photography in this, in the 21st century, you know. Well, talk about the state of trying to make a living out of photography in the 21st century.
Well, I don't envy you. Is that your full-time, I mean, I'm guessing professional photographer is, that's your occupation.
It is. Yeah, it is. And it has been for probably about 20 years. I sold my first photograph back in 1987. And it was a photograph of Worcester Cathedral. And it was shot on a Lubitel twin lens reflex camera that my wife bought me for the princely sum of £11.
Yeah, I have one of those.
And it sold. I wish I still had mine. But anyway, the photograph sold as the cover photograph for Worcestershire Life. I got £25. So I made a profit on that sale. So that was the first photograph that I sold, and I started selling more and more images, but around a full-time job. And then eventually I made that into a part-time. So I had part-time salaried work, and then eventually became a full-time professional photographer with three kids. The youngest is 30 soon. And the eldest will be 34 this year. But at the time, you know, with young kids, jumping off the cliff into freelance photography as my only source of income did not feel like a very wise thing.
Would you do it now though? I mean, with the way image making has changed, you know, with everybody having a phone and the phone capable of some amazing photographs, and you know, 30, 40 years ago, we still had agencies who'd be looking for images. I don't know whether they, you know, they were still probably looking for transparencies for image banks and things.
Yeah.
There was a barrier to entry, wasn't there, for the man on the street, you know, which perhaps these days is not there. So to jump in today, you know, would you today do what you did 30 or 40 years ago, do you think?
I'd like to think I would, because I've had such an incredible life as a result of making that jump. I remember when I was just about to make the jump, and my wife said to me with a degree of nervousness in her voice, "Do you think this is going to work?" And I said to her, "Well, all I can say is it's like a parachute jump. I've bought the best parachute I can. I've employed the best parachute packer I can. I've been through all the training, but actually I won't know until I jump out of the plane. That's the only way you find out whether it's going to work or not. And here we are many years later, and photography has taken me and us all over the world and given us some incredible experiences and enabled us to meet some really wonderful people who have become long-term friends. So I have absolutely no regrets about doing it at all. Would I do it now? I'd like to think I would, but I do think it is much harder. Certainly when I was started selling photographs, you needed to have a degree of technical expertise and understanding. Whereas now, as you say, you can point your phone and get a reasonably good, it'll be in focus and well exposed, etc., etc. You've still got to be an element of art and creativity in there. A bad photograph is still a bad photograph, whether you take it with a phone or an expensive medium format camera. I think there is still something about the photographer's vision that you can't replicate by technology, but certainly the technological side of things is much easier these days.
You talk about pinhole photography challenged your notion of what constitutes a worthwhile subject for my camera. So just before you answer that, so you were a professional photographer.
Yep.
Before, and you still are, but before you didn't start off with pinhole photography. Clearly you were a professional photographer. So yep. How did lensless photography affect your professional work, or didn't it, or is it just gives you an outlet for personal work?
No, very, very much so. It taught me that to have confidence in my own vision, that was an incredibly important thing. So just to photograph what appealed to me and the way that I saw it, and not to worry about whether anybody else might like it or buy it, and to worry about that at a later date. Who's going to pay me for this image? And I didn't worry about that at the time of taking the photograph. And that has continued right until this day, whether I'm, using a digital camera, a pinhole camera, it doesn't matter to me whether I'm using my phone. I don't worry about who else is going to like this. Pinhole photography taught me that I could take photographs for me in the way that I see the world, and I would make sales out of it. Some of my best-selling prints are my pinhole photographs.
I wonder why that is. I've got my own vision, my own ideas, but what sort of do you get feedback from customers over it? Why they particularly?
I think it's because it's that mood and emotion thing, really. I think they convey an emotion that is obviously possible through, let's call it, standard mainstream photography. But they have an atmosphere to them that seems to appeal to people. Whether it's because you've got long exposures, and so you're getting cloud movement and water movement and all of those things, and the images aren't sharp, not in a conventional sense, they're not sharp. And so all of that, I think, creates an atmosphere that people tend to respond to, even if they don't know the photograph has been taken with a pinhole camera.
No, they probably, there must be an app for that on my phone, surely.
Well, yeah, and there probably is.
Probably is.
I find that non-photographers respond very well to pinhole photographs, probably more than photographers in some ways, because some photographers get hung up on what lens did you use and how sharp is it and can you blow it up at this size and it still looks sharp, and who cares?
Well, we chat on this show at times, and I mean I use a variety of commercial pinhole cameras, so until recently I was using my Zero quite regularly, but the pinhole has now corroded away.
it got
covered in salt water,
and yep.
I never really thought twice about it other than just cleaned it up, and I was looking at it the other day and I thought, well, that looks a bit weird, and I touched it with a pen and it just broke.
Oh no.
So at the moment I have a Zero 2000 with no pinhole, but I'll remedy that. I'm tempted to make my own. I mean, I do make my own pinholes because that gives a different look as well.
Yeah.
So people can, worry about how about pinholes being too sharp. You know, I mean, I some of these laser like the Zero, but also my Reality So Subtle, made by James Guerin in France. I mean, that can be so sharp, particularly on things that are really close up. You know, that you think, well, it could almost be a lensed photograph. Yeah. You know,
well, that the photograph we were talking about before, Into the Light, I actually softened that when I print it. Because it was too sharp for me. It was too sharp.
I've sometimes when I've had that and I want it softer, I soften it as well. But I lay some tissue paper just over the print on the easel in the darkroom, and so that this is a very unrepeatable process, because when you lay it down, the tissue paper, some parts of the tissue come into contact with the paper and some don't. You know.
Yeah.
So you get a degree of difference of diffusion, and if you can't repeat it, so it's a very interesting and one-off kind of way of softening. But I think, well, why am I doing this? This is a pinhole photograph, but I want it a bit softer, you know.
So yes, that's right.
Part of me wants to go and make a pinhole for the Zero, but then I think no, because the Zero image has a certain look, and I want to replicate it. So I'll either get another pinhole from Mr. Zero Image, or I'll get one from James. But I really ought to get one from Hong Kong, really.
Yeah.
I need to reach out to him and sort that out. But the Zero image has a particular look. I mean, you can go and buy, well, indeed make, I suppose, but you can certainly buy pinhole cameras with numerous pinholes in them these days for shifting the horizon onto, you know, the bottom third or the top third.
You know.
And of course, now we're getting into decisions, and it's not quite the same as having, well, what lens should I have, but which pinhole should I use?
You know? I much prefer keeping the decisions as simple as possible. And that, you asked me before, how has pinhole photography affected what I do professionally? Well, in a number of ways, but it also has taught me to keep things simple. So, you know, go out with one camera and one lens, or certainly one camera and no more than three prime lenses. And what I've learned is that the more kit I have, the more confusing things become.
Yeah.
And I just like to keep things simple. And that actually is a photograph in the Lensless Landscapes book. And it's Elemental 2, which I'm just looking at a copy of the book, but it's fairly early on in the book. Might be the second or third image.
Oh, yeah. Elemental that bit 2. On top of Malham. Is it? Oh,
this is at Twistleton Scar. But I was out all day from early hours in the morning until after it went dark, you know, about 9 o'clock in the evening. And I was stupidly humping around a huge low-pro backpack. And in that backpack, I had a Pentax 6-7 and three lenses.
Yeah.
I had a Canon EOS 1N and three lenses, three zoom lenses. And I had a Zero Image pinhole camera. And I flogged around with that on my back all day, got back to the car absolutely shattered. And the only decent image that I got out of the day was that pinhole image. And that completely changed the way I worked. That, why am I humping all of this gear around? Make a decision. You know, are you going to go with a medium format outfit or a 35mm outfit? And I got two Zero imaging cameras, and I had one with me in either bag, and that's all I took out of me. And that's got simpler and simpler over the years, to the point where I went to Venice back in December, and I took two cameras, two prime lenses, and that was it.
So do you still practice pinhole photography? That's the burning question.
Yeah, not as much these days. I mean, partly it's a sort of business thing. I've just been so busy over the last few years, running workshops. So I'd go away, run a workshop overseas somewhere, and then come back. I'd be at home for a week playing catch up on admin, and then I would disappear off again. And so I just had less and less time for, not for pinhole photography itself, but more for the processing and scanning and all of that stuff that involves. I still have my Zero Image cameras, and I still have some film, but probably more to the point, I still have a whole load of negatives in a file in a filing cabinet that I've done nothing other than have the film processed, and well, I need to scan them and work on them.
Yeah, I was thinking about this morning. I had a backlog of film that I built up while I was enlarging my darkroom last year, and I've just finally got around to start developing some of it. And I thought, well, and I've been, anyone who's listened to me whittle on either this podcast or large format will know that I'm, and I hate the word shooting, but let's just say I'm shooting less and printing more. Yeah. Because I reckon I've got negatives in these filing cabinets next to me in my office, and also in boxes in the cupboard here, going back to the early 80s. If I sold all my cameras tomorrow, I could, you know, I'm just had my 56th birthday. I could probably print until I'm 90 if I could still doddle around, you know.
Yeah.
With the images that I've got there. And I think, why do I need to create more and more? Now, the answer is I enjoy it, you know, as everybody does, you know. But I enjoy the darkroom as well. But, you know, who doesn't like being out in the landscape with a camera and with a pinhole camera? Because, you know, it's the process, isn't it? And I enjoy the process. But the image, it's all about the final image. And if I thought, well, why don't I sell my RB67 and my Rolleiflex and my Yashica 44 that I'm looking at here, and my Toyo 45A, and I'll use watercolor paper, which I do, and some liquid emulsion, or I'll do some more lift printing, or some, make salted paper prints with just some negatives I've got, you know.
Yeah.
But then it would all be about the darkroom, and it wouldn't be about getting out. And
it's about getting that balance, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And the friendships as well. You mentioned, you know, the friendships that you've made from your professional career. I mean, I don't know how engaged you are with the Twitter sphere or Facebook, but, you know, I regularly meet up with proper people, you know. I mean, I used to go to camera clubs. You know, you talk at camera clubs. I used to go to camera clubs. It was the only way you could meet other photographers, because, you know, pre-internet days. And now I've met folks from all over the world on trips to America, you know, overseas in Europe. You send them a tweet and say, well, hey, you know, want to fancy meeting up? And they kind of know I'm not a weirdo. Well, not that much of a weirdo, really. you know, the first time I took my daughter, who's now a social worker in Liverpool, when she was probably 15 or 16, there was a Polaroid meetup. I'm still a great lover of Polaroid photography. I used to like the peel apart stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And I just got into Twitter. So it would have been about 2012, I guess, 10 years ago. And I'd got hooked up with this group of Polaroid photographers, and they were having a meetup in London. And I said to my daughter, you want to come? So we're on the train, and she said, well, do you know these? Do you know these people? I said, well, I met them online. She said, you hypocrite. I've told this story before, so apologies, but you haven't heard it, Steve. You hypocrite. What do you say? You told me not to engage with people, but when you stop traveling the world, Steve, the Twitter sphere and the Facebook sphere, if you can deal with Facebook, but the groups in particular are just wonderful places to engage with like-minded folk.
Well, one of the things that COVID brought about, surprise surprise, was it actually put a stop to my workshops, whether they were overseas or in this country. And that has given me it gave me the opportunity to move house, because my wife has been on to me for a while about moving out into the countryside, and I was never around enough to make that happen, and COVID enabled that I was. And the other thing as well is it got me off that hamster wheel of running, you know, a workshop, coming home, running another workshop. And it does, looking back on it, it was starting to feel a bit like a hamster wheel, and gave me the opportunity to reflect on, where do I want to go with my photography? What do I want to do in whatever time I've got left? What do I want to do with my photography? What do I want to say through my photographic work? I've started to reevaluate what I do. How much time do I want to spend going back through my old negatives and scanning them and working on them? Or even digital files.
What's the answer then?
Well, what I've decided to do is I'm going to continue running workshops because, as you quite rightly said, they're a good opportunity to go out and get to meet people, to meet other photographers. But instead of running workshops for photographers from sort of, you know, beginners through to experienced, I'm now focusing my time and energies on those that are the experienced end of that continuum, because the things that really excite me are talking about the aesthetics and the principles of photography, about what are you trying to say with your photographs, how do you put mood and emotion into your images, rather than spending time, and I understand people need to learn these things, but rather than spending time talking about exposure and depth of field and ISO and histograms and all of that stuff, which are the sort of basic building blocks that people need to understand. But the more interesting thing for me is the other end of that continuum. And I often say to people that are struggling with those basics, you know, this is difficult, but once you master those things, that's when you get into the really interesting aspects of photography. So I'm focusing my energies, I'm doing fewer workshops and focusing my energies more on this, what I call my masterclasses. So working with smaller groups, 3 or 4 people, but talking about what I consider to be the real important fundamentals of photography.
Wouldn't that be an ideal opportunity to revisit pinhole photography in terms of
exactly
focusing on?
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to find the time to do that. I mean, it's just still early stages of, you know, you know what it's like with, well, you know, with my business, as I often say to my wife, well, often said to my wife when she was nagging me about, you know, we need to find time to move house. And I said to her, my business is like an oil tanker. You can't just turn it round overnight. I'm already planning workshops for 2023. So it can't be turned around overnight. You can't suddenly say, I'm going to reduce the number of workshops that I'm doing. You know, it'll take 12 or 18 months, but certainly COVID, as I say, was a sort of forced interruption that gave me the opportunity to do that and the time for reflection.
I think, I think working in the darkroom for me is where things really come together in terms of presenting mood and interpreting the negative. And so do you have elements of your mostly, I guess, Lightroom, or, you know, in terms of taking the, when I say negative, you know, okay, the raw image, quite literally the raw image, and focusing on making the final image something that conveys something of the meaning of the moment or whatever the person's trying to convey. Are you bringing all that into your workshops in terms of the, you know, the technicalities of using a electronic darkroom, really?
Yes. Yeah. And I have been doing that for a while. When I'm taking a photograph, one of the key principles for me is that photography is about communication beyond I just like it. I ran a workshop in Greenland, and I had and I don't think this lady will be listening, but she's,
you never
she
know.
She wasn't into pinhole photography, but I kept saying to her, Sue, why are you taking this photograph? And she just kept saying, but it's so pretty.
Yeah.
And well, I kept and I said to her, but you can't photograph pretty. How do you photograph pretty? So you've got to define to me, what is it that makes it pretty for you? Is it the light? Is it the color? Is it the texture? What is it? When you can define that, then you can better convey that in a photograph. And I still now, we're still in touch, and I still wind her up and ask her if she's still taking photographs of pretty. But for me, you've got to be clear about what you're trying to say almost before you fire the shutter. And that runs all the way through to the processing of the image. So sometimes, you know, I'll be running workshops and somebody will say, well, process my image for me. How would you process it? And I always start with a question. What were you trying to convey with this photograph? I can tell you how I would process it, but that isn't helpful to you in terms of conveying what you wanted to say. Tell me what you were trying to say, and I can give you some ideas about how you would process that image and print it to best convey that message.
I think, well, you must have come on in leaps and bounds, because I read, I don't know whether it's in this, in the, it must have been in the Lensless Landscapes book. Use maybe you were just getting into digital darkroom work,
right?
And you were talking about fairly basic manipulation of, you know, like contrast and
And that's it's still very, you know, whether I'm shooting, you know, with a toy camera or a sophisticated digital camera, I still keep the processing as fairly simple. I'm a lazy computer operator.
If I
can do it in camera, I will. So I get mainly American friends of mine. Seems to be a bit of a sort of cultural thing, perhaps. But I get American friends of mine who really make fun of me because I still use neutral density graduated filters.
Mm, good for you. Yeah. And they must have a place. I mean, I use them all the time, but then I'm film photographer.
Yeah, yeah. And my answer to that is, well, I learned to use them when I was shooting film. Mm. And I know how to use them. I've got them, and it means I have to do less work when I've got that image in front of me on a computer screen, and that has to be good. I'd rather spend more time out in the landscape taking photographs than an extra hour on in front of the computer screen.
Yeah, I mean, controlling the negative contrast range and the density through use of such things as graduated neutral density filters into the sky, and then the choice of developer to control too much excessive density in the highlights just makes printing so much easier, you know.
Yeah.
If you can start off with what we might call a work print in traditional terms, which is full of promise, you know, if your first work print, and I can get disheartened if it's, you know, there's no detail in the sky and I can tell it's going to be a mare to print, you know. And I'm kind of lazy. I think, oh, you know, I'm going to put that negative to one side and move on. So I think having the process of exposing less film or even less digital pixels, slowing down and thinking more about what you want to achieve is a really valid thing and really floats my boat. But, you know, folks out there listening, if you want to take pinhole pictures of because you kind of like it, well, that's okay as well.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, no, that's, you know, that's cool.
Most of us aren't making a living from it, and if you want to go and put your pinhole camera up against something like a shoe and see what it looks like, because why wouldn't you? You know.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not a, even if I'm shooting digitally, I'm not a what I'd call a spray and pray photographer.
And pray. Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly clear about what is it. Certainly with my landscape photography, you know, what is it I'm trying to say here, and what elements need to come together. So, you know, which areas of the frame do I need lit? Which areas do I need in shadow? You know, am I going to use filters to control the contrast range, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is worked out beforehand. And then when it happens, so when the light happens to light the piece of the landscape that I want lit, I'll fire the shutter probably no more than twice. You know, the second one is insurance, and then I pack up, go away and do something else, because I can't stand having, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 variations on a theme and then trying to work out which one of these happens to be the best photograph.
Yeah, well, with pinhole photography, that's you probably won't end up with that anyway.
No, not at all.
Leaving digital behind for a moment,
yeah,
what I loved about going back to when I was inspired by your book Lenses Landscapes, what I was inspired by was the fact that you appeared generally in this book to be using the zero image camera more like a conventional camera. Now, than a pinhole camera, because there is a trend which I'm, you know, which I'm guilty of as well, because it looks really good. You know, put your pinhole camera up against a knife and a fork. I've got one on my Instagram page, and the fork is kind of touching the lens almost, but. And you're getting this really distorted sense of apparent perspective. And that's what pinhole photography can do really well, or putting your pinhole camera in weird places. You know, Will Gudgeon has a great YouTube channel and was on this show a few weeks back, puts his pinhole camera on his skateboard and does stuff like that. But you were taking what would appear to be a fairly conventional approach and using the strengths of the pinhole cameras in a way that a that a lensed camera would struggle with in terms of, sort of, you know, you're presenting your images in a fairly conventional composition without making them look too pinholy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I agree.
I really like that.
Thank you. Know? I mean, that was a conscious choice of, I didn't want the image to be about the technique.
Yes. That's it. Yeah.
So for me, technique, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's a Holger or, you know, I've used things like converted CCTV lenses on cameras or whether it's a pinhole camera. I don't want it to be about the fact that it's a pinhole image. Yeah. I want it to be about the image. The pinhole camera was a way of getting me to that point. The camera I use, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a phase one medium format, a Leica or a zero image pinhole camera, they tend to influence the way I work and they influence the way I see the world. And so that is enough in itself without me having to exaggerate the technique side of things.
Yeah. Anyone who gets a pinhole camera and realize that you can put it up against, I don't know, I was walking in Cambridge and there was chrome looks good on pinhole cameras, and it had the word dog on it. It was a dog pole. And so what am I going to do? I'm going to put my pinhole camera down there because it just looks like a really cool pinhole picture.
Yeah,
and that's okay. So, and I do love doing that. But what drew me to your work and what made me take a step back from how I was using a pinhole camera was your images. And I went to Venice too, and I've just dug out my negatives of Venice, and they're conventional photographs but made with a pinhole camera.
You know? Yeah. I remember going down to Norfolk, and some of the photographs are in the Lensless Landscapes book. Yes. I was down in Norfolk and I was doing a recce trip with a friend of mine to scout locations for a workshop. Mm-hmm. And we met up down there and I opened the back of my car and he said, where's your camera bag? And I said, that's it. And there's a little Billingham bag and it had 2 zero image cameras in there. And I said to him, and you know, one's loaded with 400 ISO film, the other one's loaded with 50 ISO film, all black and white. And he said to me, but what if you see a wonderful sunset or a sunrise? Yeah, and I said, well, I can't take it. No. Well, what about if you see a photograph that needs a 200mm lens?
I can't take it.
And what using the pinhole camera taught me was what it was good at and what it wasn't good at, and how to make the most of its strengths, but not to let that dominate how I saw the world. But it taught me that to accept whatever the limitations are. So, for instance, there was no point in me wandering around looking at photographs that would work well with a 200mm lens.
No.
So I just stopped looking at those things and I just concentrated on what the camera was good at and photographed those things. And I didn't worry about anything else. In fact, you know, you asked me before, how's it influenced my subsequent sort of professional work? I guess what it taught me was, you know, I've become not only more Buddhist in hairstyle, but in but in philosophy as I've got older. And it's, you know, it is what it is. And I can only work with whatever equipment or tools I have with me and just learn to make the best of those things. And that was a really important lesson from using the zero image camera. It is what it is. Play to its strengths. Don't worry about the weaknesses.
I think if I had to choose, and I haven't got as many cameras as a lot of my friends have, but if I had to get rid of everything, I would, and just go down to one or two, I would probably end up with a pinhole camera and my Holger.
Yeah.
And I think those two would allow me to convey meaning and thought and into image making and printmaking. And in a way, life would be so much easier. First of all, they wouldn't be very heavy, would they? So
no, I
wouldn't have to worry about carting them around.
Yep.
And but I can't at the moment bring myself to part with all these beautiful things. You know?
Yeah, we talked earlier about, you know, keeping things simple.
Yeah.
And yes, there's an element of, you know, you don't want to carry a whole heavy backpack around for hours and hours on end. But the other thing is that it forced me to concentrate on my vision. You know, I wasn't confused or distracted by what kit I had. The kit I had was very simple. And so it either worked because I could see the photograph and translate that into a final print, or it didn't. It was just down to me. That's how it felt. It was down to me and my vision. It wasn't, you know, did I have the right lens with me or not? It was very, very simple. And it forced me to focus on what I consider now to be the essentials.
Yeah. I think we'll begin to wind things up. One area which I know many pinhole aficionados are drawn towards is this notion of pinhole photography capturing not just a moment in time, but whole chunks of time. And I know it's something that you've engaged with, and I think you write about in your book. I mean, I particularly like pointing my camera into direct sunlight, so you get to see the rays of the sun. Well, I don't know if they really are the rays of the sun, but it's just the way it's recorded, and it looks like you're recording the sunlight, doesn't it?
Yeah. I again, one of the influences on my professional photography with standard cameras is that I learned to love the effect of long exposures. You have no choice. You know, with an aperture of f/138, nearly every exposure was except for the half a second I referred to before, but every exposure was a relatively long exposure. And I really liked the drama that brought to an image. And that could be drama in a very sort of dynamic way, you know, a very moody shot, but also create a drama in a sense of stillness and peace and tranquility. And using the pinhole camera enabled me to start to see the world through that lens, through that pinhole. And then I tried to work out, so how can I take that lesson and apply that to my photography with a digital camera? And so that's how I got into doing long exposures with neutral density filters, because I did like the that sense of energy that you get in a landscape photograph from a long exposure of several seconds or minutes.
Well, if folks want to go and look at a variety of your work, including pinhole and all your portfolio work and workshop details, your blog, which is not up to date, Steve, I have to say.
No, it's not. No, that's one of the things that went sort of by the by with running around the hamster wheel, which is something else I want to get back to.
Yeah, well, it looked very entertaining. I've just read a bit about Elliot Erwitt, but we won't go there. So that's Steve Gosling, StevGosling, photography.co.uk. I'll put a few links and things that we've been chatting about into the podcast. But your book, and you know, you can catch up with Steve and see what else he's been up to since the pinhole days, and you can send him an email and encourage him to do more pinhole photography.
And people can sign up for my newsletter if they go on the website. They'll find out more about what I'm up to.
So my copy of Lensless Landscapes is signed by you and is number 184 of 1,000. I think it says 1,000.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And so if folks want to get a copy of Lensless Landscapes, can they still?
They can. Yeah, I've got a few copies left. I think we're up to 780 something now in terms of numbers. I knew it was never going to be the world's biggest seller in terms of selling out, but I still have copies and I still get regular orders for them. And as a special offer to listeners today, I would normally sell it these days for £25 plus postage and packing, and I can ship anywhere in the world. I'll sell it for £18 plus postage and packing if people just email me and just refer to the Lensless podcast, and I will happily give them that discount.
Okay. I'll thank you very much. I'll put that into the Facebook group as well, Steve.
Thank you.
So just looking at my notes, I can't think we're just about an hour or so. So I think we're probably about there. We missed Corey. You didn't get to speak with Corey.
No.
But he passed on his best wishes and said, well,
please give mine back.
Yeah.
And good to chat to you, Andrew. I've enjoyed it. It's good fun.
Okay. So any other social media outlets other than your website? I think you are on Twitter.
I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Yeah, there are links on the website.
There you go. So you can engage with Steve through all the usual channels. And, just leaves me to say thank you so much for a wonderful, engaging conversation. And I'm finally glad to have caught up with you.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks very much, Andrew. And thanks for everyone for listening in.
Thanks, Steve. Take care. Bye.
Take care, Andrew. Bye.